Well, I put the restriction quasi-linear PDEs since in semi-linear case one can get some different results, and maybe I will come back later. Well, but let me start with some order. I think the point is that I am interested in qualitative theory of partial differential equations. So, and moreover of Hamiltonian partial differential equation. Essentially, I am interested in taking a nonlinear partial differential equation and try to describe the shape of the solutions, at least of some classes of solutions, possibly all, but in general one does not succeed. And moreover, I am interested in partial differential equation in domains with finite volume. So typically one has to deal with discrete spectrum and not with continuous spectrum. Again, if I, maybe I will say something on the case of continuous spectrum, but this is a slightly related problem. So the kind of results I want to discuss are a kind of Birkhoff normal form results for some partial differential equation. And for people who do not know what is Birkhoff normal form, I just summarize the fact that the idea is that one can get some prevision on the dynamics, and in particular that the solution will be essentially on an infinite dimensional torus, not forever, but for a long time. And I will say later what does I mean by long time. There are usually small parameters, and so it is related to this kind of objects. I will also discuss some applications, essentially an application to the water wave problem and an application to quasi-linear wave equations, quasi-linear abstract object, a model problem, say. But a scheme, first of all, I will split, well, I forgot to start the chronometer. Well, it's just up to the end of the public. So I will say, as a first part, I will speak about finite dimensional systems. So just to recall what Birkhoff normal form is. Then I will discuss a model. I will show how a partial differential equation can be reduced to the standard cases, essentially taking in mind a model problem. I will present a standard model problem that is the wave equation that everybody knows. One could say the Klein-Gordon equation with some nonlinearity that is essentially on a segment, and also with a vanishing boundary condition. That is the first model problem one has in mind. Then present some abstract theorem. Four applications. And five, there is a point. You will see that the abstract theorem I will present is something that when you see it, you will not like. I mean, as a result, you will immediately see that there is some strong limitation. And I want to discuss the problem more of whether this limitation can be overcome or not. Essentially, the problem is that of extension of the time of validity of the result. Well, and then we see the time. Good. So let me start with the first part. And first of all, the system I want to discuss are Hamiltonian systems. where the Hamiltonian is sum of a finite number of harmonic oscillators, exactly n harmonic oscillators, and I write it in this form. You will see in a while why these are harmonic oscillator, unless you immediately recognize, plus some perturbation. And I think, well, here canonically conjugate, the symplectic form is this, so that the Hamilton equation of the system are simply Z dot J equal I derivative of H with respect to Z bar, and the other one Z bar dot minus I dH over dZ J. I am thinking of this as a Taylor expansion at an equilibrium. So this part will describe the linearized dynamics, and this part will describe higher order terms. So I put an assumption on the nonlinear part, namely the obvious assumption in case this is a Taylor expansion, this has a zero of third order at the origin. Here Z stays for Z and Z bar, say. So I will also denote by H0 the Hamiltonian of this linearized part. What are the features of the dynamics in which I am interested? Say, just to start with, I consider the linearized case. So I consider the case where the nonlinear part is zero. Very quickly, one sees that, yes? Yes. Yes. Yes.
And it is not necessary that V bar is conjugate of V.
That's a good point. It's not necessary that Z bar is conjugated to Z, but the point is that if you assume that this Hamiltonian has some property, in practice, the property that if Z is conjugate to Z bar, this is a real valued function, then it happens that if you take an initial datum where Z is actually the conjugate of Z bar, then this property is maintained by the dynamics. As you can immediately see from the equation. If you take the complex conjugate of one, you get the other one. So you have to assume some reality property of the Hamiltonian if you want to think of this as a system coming from a real system and not a complex system. I wrote in this way because it is useful for what follows, essentially. But if you want, you can think of real and complex real variables, saying that Zj is some Pj plus iQj. And P and Q are are conjugate variables in the standard sense of Hamiltonian theory. I never remember. Real and independent. Yes.
And in fact, if you start on that substation which they're dependent, and if P is real, then they stay. P is real on that substation, and they stay. Complicated.
Yes, but.
Subtle, because you call the V bar.
Yes, it's a matter of notation. When I write a paper, I usually like to call it with a different name. But, well, indeed, one usually writes down only one equation, so it's a matter just of language, say. Good. Anyway, just first of all, I want to try to convince you of a trivial fact, namely that these are harmonic oscillators. So that if P, the perturbation, is equal to zero, then the Hamilton equation, I write just the first, are Z, G dot equal to I omega j zj, just the derivative of h0 with respect to omega bar. The solution is immediate. Z of t is the zj of t is some constant that I will call alpha j multiplied by exponential of I omega j t. So you see that every solution is every variable just oscillates. I wrote down this thing for in order to point out what are the features I am really interested in. And the first one is that if you look at that, you immediately say that the modulus of zj is a constant of motion. Actually, it does not depend on time, since this is just the modulus of alpha j square. And, well, these quantities are important and are called the actions of the system. So the main property I want to look at is this one. What does it happen to these quantities when I add the nonlinearity, p? And before doing that, let me say an immediate consequence of this fact is that if I define a torus contained in the phasor space as the manifold of the couple z, z bar in, say, c to n, such that zj square is equal to alpha j, this is an invariant manifold of the system, since the solution will remain on it for every time. So that's the point, and these are the two properties I want to investigate, essentially. So, trivial remark, what can one say if the perturbation P is different from zero? The idea is that if I take a small initial datum, then the solution will, then the perturbation P, since it has a zero of third order at the origin, will essentially be small, and so will not affect the dynamics. And, well, let's see what can one say without doing essentially nothing, without doing anything. So, first of all, take an initial datum with small norm. I call epsilon the norm of the initial datum, and I think of a small norm. Then I can obviously write down the formula of variation of constant and obtain that this is I omega j zj plus, excuse me, z dot is I omega j zj plus I derivative of p with respect to z bar j, formula of variation of constant, zj of t equal ei omega j t alpha j, the initial datum, plus the integral from 0 to t I omega j t minus s, derivative of p with respect to z bar j of z of s, z bar of s, in the s. I want to obtain an estimate for the solution. I just do this trivial computation, take the norm of this, and obtain that the norm of z of t is smaller than the norm of alpha plus the integral from 0 to t I should put a norm here. But now I use the fact that P has a zero of third order, so its derivative has a zero of second order, and it means that the derivative of P with respect to Z bar at a point is smaller than a constant, say, times the norm of the solution to the square. And so here I get that this is smaller than a constant times the norm of Z of S to the square in this. Well, now, by a Gronwald type argument, it's immediate to obtain that the solution is smaller than the norm of the initial datum minus divided by this quantity, standard inequalities. And the point is that if the norm of alpha is equal to epsilon, the norm of the initial datum is small, then until the time at which this is 1/2, this is controlled. So until the time smaller of 1 over 2 C epsilon, one has that this denominator is bounded by 1/2, and the norm of Z of T is bounded by 2 epsilon. So essentially, one immediately obtains that if one starts with a small initial datum, then up to long times, the solution continues to have a small norm. And then one can say again that up to these times, this quantity has a zero of second order. So until this time, this quantity evaluated on the solution is smaller than a constant time epsilon square. And so one can compute, for example, the derivative of ij with respect to t, that I recall you is the derivative of the modulus of each of these quantities with respect to time. And estimate, well, the linear part has no effect. The nonlinear part, if you think just a moment, you realize that it is bounded by this quantity. Essentially because, it is bounded by this quantity up to these times. So, the main remark is that if you add the nonlinearity P, then the quantities ij are no more constant, but move slowly in time. So in particular, one has that, again, up to the time scale that I put up, one has that, one has nothing, essentially. But they move slowly. It means that if I consider a time scale slightly shorter than this one, I mean, say, epsilon to the sigma, where sigma is strictly smaller than 1, then one gets that the change of the actions is smaller than a constant time epsilon, I should say, to the 2, epsilon to the 1 minus sigma. I separated this quantity because this is the order of magnitude of this. Is here, excuse me. Ij of t is the modulus of zj at time t along the solution square. And again, third point, one can deduce that if one defines again the torus Tn alpha, on which the modulus of zj square is equal to some fixed quantities, ij is equal to the initial value of the alpha j's, then this is no more invariant, but since these quantities move slowly, one can deduce that the distance of the solution from this torus is smaller than epsilon to the 1 plus sigma half over these times. And a small picture. A small picture is that we have the origin. We have a ball of radius epsilon. In this ball, we have the torus identified by the initial datum. Then I have a small band close to this torus, of size, say, epsilon power 1 plus sigma half. And the trivial result from here is that the solution remains in this small band in this of this close to the torus up to this time scale here.
And look, just to count codimension, I mean, the ball is a 2n dimensional thing.
Yes.
The torus within it is an n dimensional set. So this is a tubular neighborhood. It's a 2n dimensional, but there's n of its dimensions are epsilon to the 1 plus 6 and 2 small.
Yes. Excuse me, if I write in terms of real variables, this means that this is constant. Good?
But Andre says there's no RJ and SJ, which are the real and imaginary components of the bar.
Yes, so the point is that in the complex case, in the complex case, well, how is the situation in the complex case? Well, that's the point. If you are in the complex case, and if you take initial datum, such initial data, such that Z is the complex conjugate to Z bar, then you are in Cn, essentially. And then this is the correct picture. Indeed, the point is that you need a C2N in order for the proofs, but that's another game, I mean. As I showed you, it is trivial.
Oh.
I made all the computations.
No, I don't see this how it's 1 plus sigma over 2.
I mean, if... this has some subtleties due to the fact that there is a singularity at the origin of the derivatives of these functions, but it is a computation, essentially. It's very easy. You can guess, because they are just... these IJs have a minimum at the origin. You have to think as quadratic polynomials. So if you take a slice, you control by the 8, you control the square root of the distance, essentially. That's where the half comes from. It's not very important, I mean, this point. You just have to write, well, it's better for this estimate to use the real notation, and you just use some estimate of the kind that if you want to study the distance from the torus, well, it's something like pj minus p bar j square plus qj minus q bar j over square. The inf for pj, p bar j, q bar j in the torus. That's the point. And then you expand the square and you find quite easily the point. Okay, how to improve the game? The point is how to... how to try to get longer times, so possibly to get times that are 1 over epsilon to the m with m very large, and to get a better control, namely to obtain that the distance of the solution may be from a different torus, is smaller than epsilon to the n, maybe with n much bigger than 1. That's the problem I am interested in. Well, the idea is by Birkhoff, and is to look for a canonical transformation eliminating the nonlinearity. Maybe I don't describe how to obtain the result. I just state the theorem. By Birkhoff. Assume that the frequencies omega, that means the vector of the frequencies, is non-resonant, and by this I mean that omega scalar product with k is different from 0 when k is an integer vector. One. And two, regularity, P is C infinity, then for any R integer, there exists a canonical transformation, TR, defined in a neighborhood of the origin to Cn, such that the transformed Hamiltonian is just the linear part plus some part in normal form that I am going to describe in a while, plus some remainder of order R, R. Properties, the remainder evaluated at point Z is smaller than a constant times the norm of Z to power R plus 1. And the normal form is not a general function of Z and Z bar, but is a function only of the modulus of Zj square. So, for all J, so say Z1, Zn square. Well, and why is this interesting? Well, if one knows something of Hamiltonian theory, immediately recognize that these are the actions. And so in particular, that if one computes the derivative of the actions, this will be just the Poisson bracket of ij with the remainder. I mean that the normal form does not contribute to the motion of the actions. And that this has a zero of high order at the origin. So close to the origin, this is a very small quantity. And then the action move very, very slowly. I'm going to, well, in a while, I'm going to do that. If one is not familiar with that, there is, I think, the simplest way to see is forget about R. Suppose for a while that this is exactly zero. Then one has the system with Hamiltonian linear part plus just the part in normal form. Please. Yes. Yes, of course. Excuse me. Now, can you repeat the question? Yeah.
And I've also seen conditions where it's non-resonant, but you're only looking at the lattice within the ball.
Yes.
You're looking at the entire lattice. You just ask that it's not too close to the lattice points within the ball.
Yes. Yes, no, I can tell things. Since the question arises, I address the question. I mean, it takes a few minutes, so I go. Well. That's the game.
This is a non-resonance condition. You can get rid of all non-linearities and end it up to zero. Of course, there would be no convergence.
Of course. That's why I said for any R. Well, I made some confusion about this Z and Z bar. If the perturbation P contains both Z and Z bar, you actually need all conditions. So you are not doing half of the theory. If it contains only Z, the situation is different, I mean. But I think of the perturbation as containing Z and Z bar.
Does it mean that non-resonance condition with respect to two n variables, perhaps?
No, it is with respect to n variables because there are n frequencies. I am not sure I understand your question. Well, I think I understand her question. And the point is the following. If I told you that assume that condition, then for any R there exists. You could say something different. I mean, suppose you give me in advance the order you want to reach, then what you know is that you need this condition only up to finite order. Then if you tell me you want to reach order R, then the condition you need is just this. And k different from zero. So the point is, suppose now I am interested in increasing R and to get some convergence result or some KAM type theory. Then, well, there is one point again, that is this condition has an immediate consequence. Since there are only finitely many points with this property, then one has also that if one compute the infimum of this quantity, this is bounded away from zero. This is the infimum over finitely many positive quantities, so it is positive. But usually this is a function of R and of the dimension. When you do KM theory, what you assume a condition of Diophantine type, that means that this is larger than k to some power r. So that these small denominators decrease as a power of k, essentially. As a power of, excuse me, not r. I wrote a stupid thing. Decrease with the order as a power. That typically is n, because you can prove that in this case this is fulfilled for most values of omega. So, does this answer your question? No. No, the point is that there is one problem, is that I erased this object. You have this is smaller than a constant. Well, let me write both variables. Is that this constant goes to infinity. Typically, this quantity behaves some like r to power n, the dimension factorial. Excuse me, r factorial power n. So there is no convergence at all. And that's why you need something more subtle to do things. I mean, if you try to optimize this R, you get some exponential estimate of the remainder with this condition. Or otherwise, you have to do KM theory in order to obtain tori, but you have to restrict to a Cantor set and so on. It's slightly more complicated. Good. Go on. If you want to obtain the exponential estimate, yes. If you want to obtain just Birkhoff normal form theorem, again, if you ask that it is a C infinity for any R, you can do the normal form. Otherwise, you can ask finite regularity related to the order you want to reach.
Analytic.
I mean, if you take z as a function. Yes.
Then how, what is the h over the d? You think about the
yes.
variables.
You have to think of them as real variables, essentially. If you take infinity.
All real motions.
Yes.
Not just complex differentiable and anti-complex differentiable.
All,
I mean,
all
yes.
Because absolute value of z squared is z times y. It's not analytic.
It's not analytic. It's a function of both functions. I mean, you write z as a function of as p plus eq, real and imaginary part. It is differentiable with respect to each of these variables independently. You don't ask a Cauchy property. Yes, that's good. That's good, but just a moment. Real part of Z just means essentially that it is Q. Excuse me, P. So it's good. You take the derivative with respect to P. Real part of Z in this context, you have to think as Z plus Z bar divided by 2. Then, that's the point. So, I understand maybe your point. The point is, if Z, well, okay. No, well, I think that there is something serious in his question. And the point is that if you want to look at this, actually, as a function of z and z bar, as independent variable, you are true. You need to have analyticity for both variables. And what one usually has in mind with this notation is just that z is is p plus IQ, and Z bar is the complex conjugate. So you think of this. It is just a notation for this object as a function of P and Q. What you are saying is equivalent to say, I am interested to complexify this P and Q so that the two become independent. Then this as a function of P and Q to be able to complexify, it must be some analytic functions. But if you want this, you have to think only as a function of P plus IQ, P minus IQ. Does this answer to your question? This is a real-valued function of small p and q. And then everything is well defined. If you want to complexify, then the game is more complicated. Good? I guess it was not a good choice to speak about complex variables. I expected to show also some part of the proof, and then this was useful, but so it was really useless. So, let me try to conclude rapidly, and, okay, what is the kind of result one gets is exactly the one that is written down there. So,
whenever there is no remainder.
when there is no remainder, what happens is that Z bar J is the derivative of H0, say the derivative of H I with respect to Z bar, and this is the derivative, since this is a function only on the action, with respect to IJ times the derivative of IJ with respect to Z bar J, then this is I derivative of H with respect to IJ times ZJ. And if you compute Z bar dot J, this is exactly equal to minus the derivative I, the derivative of H with respect to I bar J, Z bar J. Conclusion. If I take, I multiply the first by Z bar J, the second by ZJ, I get here Z bar J, ZJ. You sum up and you obtain that the derivative with respect to time of ZJ, Z bar J, that is the sum of these two quantities, is the sum of these two quantities, so it is a zero. And so the action do not move due to the presence of the of Z. And so the picture is exactly of this type, in the sense that one has that if one adds the remainder, the derivative of the action with respect to time turns out to be something of order epsilon to the r plus 1. And so one obtained that if I give you R1 and R2 such that R1 plus R2 are equal to this big R, the motion of the actions is smaller than a constant time epsilon to the R1 for modulus of T smaller than 1 over epsilon to the R2. Here I could, I had a 1 around, so here I have a 1, say. So finally, the action moves very little for longer and longer time scales. Please. Epsilon, the norm of the initial datum. Epsilon. So the point is, give me since R is arbitrary, you can give me arbitrarily R1 and R2, and you get that each action moves of a very little quantity for very, very long times.
Of course, you get the neighborhood, which is
valid. Shrinks, yes. The neighborhood shrinks in R. Good. Just maybe three words. If one takes, for example, this equation, how to, one can convert it in the other equation. in the Hamiltonian problem by taking u of x t with on a segment with the Dirichlet boundary condition. If I take a Fourier expansion, I get exactly the situation of harmonic oscillator. The energy of the system can be written as sum of pk square plus omega k square qk square divided by 2 plus terms of order pq 4. Then one can get these horrible variables, complex variables, say with omega k, that is square root of k square plus m square. And find pk over omega k plus I qk square root omega k, and one gets exactly the expression above. So one has to think as the complex, as the variables as of a Fourier, as the z and z bar as Fourier coefficient of a function. That's the point. What's the problem in order to extend Birkhoff normal form result is what Mary said, namely that if you fix, for example, the order you want to reach, then you have that the infimum for k smaller than r of this quantity, as I said, in finite dimension, this is greater than a constant that usually depend on R and on the number of degrees of freedom. In this case, N is infinity, and what it typically happens is that this tends to zero as N tends to infinity. So one has a small denominators also at any finite order. What one can do is to control the way these small denominators goes to zero as the number of degrees of freedom increases. So consider a cutoff of the a cutoff system that is a finite dimensional system, and to say what does it, and to assume some control on the decreasing of these quantities as n tends to infinity. And that's what I assume. So, assumption. Give me R. Then the assumption is there exist constants gamma and alpha such that the small denominators when you meet when you cut off the system goes to zero as n to the alpha at worst. Second assumption I need is a regularity assumption. Horribly. Well, typically in cases where you do computations, alpha is something that goes to some number. gamma delta, say. That's the simplest to control. Gamma is also bad, but this is bad enough not to to invite to make more computation, I think.
This is determined by M.
In this case, yes. What you can prove is that there exists a set of, if you take M as belonging to a set, say, 0 delta, for any delta, there exists a subset of full measure such that this is fulfilled. With different values, of course. If you fix the values small, then the measure tends to be full as gamma tends to 0. Good. So probably you should change the parameters, alpha and gamma. Good. Say, just the regularity assumption, you need some topology, and the topology on the phase space is that natural, keeping in mind that these are Fourier coefficient. So I define the norm S of Z as the sum of J to the 2, the norm square to the 2S modulus of ZJ square. So it corresponds to the Sobolev norm. And the assumption is that for any S larger than some S0, the vector field of the perturbation, this is the Hamiltonian vector field, is a smooth function, I should say, well, say C infinity, from U S plus D to P to, I did not choose. The notation is that this is the space L to S. This space is usually denoted as L to S, where this U S plus D is a neighborhood of the origin in the topology L to S plus D. So the correct statement is that there exists a D and a neighborhood of the origin in L2S plus D such that the Hamiltonian vector field of the perturbation is smooth as a map from this neighborhood to this. What does it mean? It means that the incoming function can be D times more regular than the outcoming function, so that this vector field is allowed to extract D derivatives, essentially. And with these two assumptions, exactly the same statement of Birkhoff theorem holds, but now you have to tell me what does it mean that this is small, that the remainder is small. And the remainder small, then I stop, means that if you construct the vector field, you evaluate at a point Z, you measure its norm, a given Sobolev norm, then this is controlled by a constant times the norm of the point at which you evaluate to a given power, the power you wanted, but a more regular norm. So the statement is there exists S prime such that this estimate holds. This means one has to think of the remainder as something extracting S prime derivatives, where S prime, in general, is a number, is a very large number. So the point is that one has, a normal form but the remainder has to be, in this estimate, is something that it is very singular, since in general it is the object that extracts more derivatives. Well, I have to point out that actually in the case, for example, of this equation, one can prove that actually S prime is equal to zero. So it is a much stronger result. But in the case of just with this assumption, I say this is the result. And last word, how to use it for to construct the dynamics. Suppose I give you from the exterior some estimate, some a priori estimate of the solution, so that you know that the solution remains small, smaller than epsilon, up to a given time scale, say something like that. Then you are able to insert here this estimate to obtain that this is order epsilon to the r plus 1, and to deduce qualitative information on the dynamics. Actually, from Grönvall-Lem, this is automatic in semilinear cases, and in some quasi-linear cases it can be proved, for example, using Kato's theory. I did some cases. So the kind of things is that even if the remainder extracts a lot of derivative, as far as you know that the solution remains small, you immediately get the shape of the solutions that are, they turn on tori and so on. I think it's time to stop.